Applause to Lynn A.
I'm going to leave now in case you don't clap that much at the end. Hi, my name is Lynn Angelette, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I'd like to welcome the newcomers. I did not come in here grateful. I was angry and resentful. I had to be here because he had a problem. So for those of you who come in and feel at home, I'm really happy for you. That wasn't my experience. I used to come home from these meetings. I used to say, how long do I have to go to these meetings? And my husband would say, until you want to. So that was my start in Al-Anon. I'd like to thank Jack and Alex for asking me to speak tonight. Jack warned me that it was really hot with the lights, and I informed him once you turn 55, you take your jacket off anyway, so it's okay. So we're set. Also, happy birthday to all the birthday people. How exciting to see that many years of Al-Anon program at one time. And it was incredible. I'm going to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I did not grow up with any alcoholism. I grew up in what I thought was a normal family. I've come to realize we all think our family was normal until we get out there and see other people's families don't do it like our family. So I grew up in a family where I am the youngest of three children. I learned at a young age to learn how to manipulate that around and to get my way. It is very easy when your older brother, you pick on him, he hits you, you get in a fight, you cry, he gets in trouble. It works really well. And, you know, I used to say I didn't have any alcoholism in my family growing up, and I didn't. However, since we were adults, my sister has been arrested for embezzlement and because she is a compulsive gambler. And I had to make the choice in Al-Anon not to bail her out of jail. And I really believed that she would never speak to me again after we made that decision. And she does. I'd like to tell you today we have a really close relationship. But the reality is, when I got in Al-Anon, in order to have a relationship with her, I used to get on my knees and I used to ask God to let me talk to her for 5 minutes without judging her or anything, because I had to make an amends for judging her. And so what I did to start my relationship with her is I'd get on my knees, I'd call her, and I'd look at the clock, and when 5 minutes went by, all I did when she talked was say, and after 5 minutes, I'd say, you know, I have to go now. And that's how our relationship started again. And over the years, she lives in a different state, and over the years, we've been closer, not as close. And I decided last year that I, for my part, I needed to call her once a month. So I called the first month, and she didn't call back, and I called my sponsor. I said, well, I called, and she said, so I guess you'll do it again next month. And I called the next month, and I called for 4 months before she actually answered the phone and called back. And now I've been calling her every month, and about every 2 or 3 months, she answers the phone. And that's the best she can do, and that's the best I can do. You've taught me in this program that I need to be loving and compassionate. What the other person does is not my responsibility. My brother, who is 2.5 years older than me and I was close to growing up. He doesn't live too far from me, and I watched him a couple of years ago when we were at a barbecue, and he told us he had just cut down from 27 Percocet or Vicodin or whatever he was taking to only 17, and he was doing much better, and we saw him washing them down with alcohol. And you know what? I didn't have to say anything. I know he knows we're both in program, and I didn't say anything. And I just loved him, and I called him once a month to see how he was doing. And then one day, he called me and said I had to go into rehab, and he's clean and sober as far as I know today. So that's the story of my family that grew up with no alcoholism. My mother loved me so much, she did everything for me, and so what I grew up thinking is I was not capable of doing anything for myself. I'm sure that is not the message she wanted to give me. I also watched Cinderella. All I wanted was Prince Charming to take care of me and make my life wonderful, and I never told a man I dated that that was what he was supposed to do, but I knew it in my head. My mother told me, you marry a professional, that's your same religious background, and you will be happy the rest of your life. So I met this poor boy when he was 15 and a half. No, he was 16. I was 15 and a half. And I took him hostage for the next 10 years because he fit the qualifications. And, you know, we went all through high school and college together, and then we got married. And I have to tell you, the only reason I stand in front of you with a college degree is because when I started college, my mother said the dreaded words, "You are our last hope for a college graduate." I was afraid of my mother. She was tough as nails, and there was no way I was going to come home and tell her I wasn't graduating. And so that's the only reason I have my college degree. And so this man and I went all through high school and college together, and we got married after I graduated college. And the story of my life is very simple. It's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. My ex-husband did not drink, and he was too boring. The next man in my life is a practicing alcoholic, and he was too exciting. And then I married my husband now, who was sober, and he's just right. So. You know, when I was with my ex-husband, when we were still married, I loved, somebody said, you know, in Al-Anon, if you come around long enough, people give you ways to phrase things a lot better than you think. So I like this. When I was married to my ex-husband, I had an overlapping relationship. And well, I met this man, and he was really exciting, and I knew I'd be exciting, too, if I hung out with him. And I did not know anything about alcoholism. I thought you had to carry your bottle in a bag, and you had to wear a trench coat, and that made you an alcoholic. And this man wore a three-piece suit and worked at a bank, so he couldn't be an alcoholic. I could not find somebody geographically desirable, so I had to find somebody in Texas. And so when I'd call him and say, "You can't come to California because this weekend," he'd say, "You know, that's really bad news. I have to drive to the 7-Eleven and get some beer. I'll call you back." I think, isn't he macho? And you know, we started this whirlwind three-year relationship. And I'm not going to tell you about his insanity because I had so much insanity and I wasn't drinking. You know, I started the waiting up till 4 in the morning, looking out the window, and then when you see them, you jump in bed so they don't know you've been waiting up, and then you pretend you're asleep, and when they come in, oh, they woke you up. And I learned early on, I used to think I was a really nice person, but what I learned early on is that when we had those times, if I was really angry and miserable, then we'd get in a fight. But if I was really nice, so if he said, "I'm hungry, I would really like some breakfast," and I got up and made him breakfast at 4 in the morning, he felt so guilty the next day. It was so nice. I could get whatever I wanted. And, you know, it took me a long time to realize that I didn't think most people had to be treated poorly before they were treated well. But that became a pattern in our relationship, and it was okay, because that worked for us. And, you know, the solutions to his problems were... My solutions were worse than the problems. You know, this man that I thought had so much class, when we'd go to parties, he'd run out of cigarettes and he'd be a little drunk and he would take other people's cigarette butts out of the ashtray and start smoking them. Now, I'm great with an alcoholic as long as you're in your box, and your box means you're not embarrassing me and making me not look good. So I'd carry a pack of cigarettes. I didn't smoke, so he wouldn't embarrass me. I'd have his cigarettes. You know, any violence that took place in that house was not him, it was me. He would call my mother a four-letter word, and I'd slap him in the face. And I'd like to tell you, I had so much anger in that relationship. I was at an AA meeting one night with my husband, and somebody asked the speaker, "How do you know if you're in a good marriage?" And she'd been married 5 times, so I figured she must know. And she said that her husband brings out the best in her, and she brings out the best in her husband. I believe we do that for each other. This man and I, when we were together, we brought out the very worst in each other. He brought out that temper in me that I didn't even know I had. And it was all for me about looking good on the outside, and that's all I wanted to do. And so we just played these games. We did look good on the outside, but if you came in our house, it was miserable. We were both miserable, and I also started doing these things like... we would drive and we'd be 5 miles from the house, and we'd get in a fight and I'd say, "Let me out of the car," and he would, and I'd walk home 5 miles in the dark thinking he's going to be waiting, worried, and he'd go to a bar. And probably what should have been my bottom with this man, but I have a very high tolerance for pain. We went to his, actually what happened is, when the alcoholics talk about they have these solutions, they only drink on weekends, well, we decided if we didn't live together and we just dated, then things would go back to what they were like at the beginning. And so we had been living in West LA, and I moved back to San Fernando Valley with my parents. And And what happened was he invited me to his company Christmas party, and I don't know how the Alcoholics in Your Life party, but they had to start drinking at lunch. And then we had to meet at a bar after work so they could drink enough to go to the party. Now, we don't give advice in Al-Anon, but when you know somebody's drank that much and they say the words, "Why don't you leave your car? I'll drive." It's not a good idea. But I did, because I didn't want to fight. So I got in the car with him. We drove down by the beach where the party was. And when he fell on the floor in front of his, on the dance floor in front of all his bosses, we thought maybe it was time to leave. And we left, and he drove me down by the beach, and he told me to get out of the car. What Al-Anon has given me is choices. It never once occurred to me that night to call a cab, to call my parents, to call a friend. My best thinking said I had to walk back to my car those 26 blocks and that I couldn't go down Santa Monica or Wilshire. My ego said, what if somebody sees me? So I picked the darkest street to walk down because I was so humiliated. And I was walking back, and a man pulled up and asked me for directions. And I didn't know where he was going, and he made a U-turn, and he said, "Look, you're obviously in trouble and need to get to your car. I promise I won't touch you. All I ask is that I have another car that needs to be jump-started if you follow me over." You know, and I got in the car with that man, and he indeed had another car that needed to be jump-started, and I followed him over, and we tried to jump-start it. And all that man ever asked me for was my work phone number, and he called the next day to make sure I got home on time. Okay. Now, even after all that, the first thing I did was drive over that man's apartment to see if he was home, and he wasn't home. So I drove back to San Fernando Valley, and I got home. My mother said, "Where have you been? He's been arrested for drunk driving. We have to go bail him out of jail." So we drove all the way back to Santa Monica. I didn't have any collateral. My parents had to put up everything they had to bail him out of jail. And we bailed him out of jail, and we got in the car, and I didn't know anything about blackouts. So when he said to me, "Why did you leave that party with the girl that I work with?" And I told him what happened, he called me a liar in front of my parents. And, you know, I absolutely knew it was over. I just knew that was my incomprehensible demoralization, and I knew I was done. So I drove home, and we got home at like 4 in the morning, and I had to be at work at 6, and I'm a responsible Al-Anon, so I got my 1 hour sleep, and I got up, and I was at work, perky. Oh, I'm so happy I'm here. And the next morning, he called me, and he said those three magic words, "I need you." So I was right back there, because now it was going to be different, because now he needed me. And, you know, when I look back at my life, I'm so grateful for everything that happened in the order it happened. And even though at the time, the seemingly bad turns out to be good and what we need. Because I had moved home in November, and this was in December. And in January, my mother was killed in a car accident. And, you know, I was 25 years old, and my mother had just died. And my father told us that you kids have to be strong for me. So I thought that meant that I had to stuff my feelings. I was so angry, and yet I knew being angry was the wrong thing. I don't know how I knew that, but I knew it was. So I just stuffed all those feelings, and I went back to work. And I can remember going to work, and this relationship was falling apart. My mom had just died, and I remember somebody at work saying, "Oh, what's wrong? You don't look like... You look like there's something wrong." And I said, "Oh, no, everything's just fine. Must just be having a bad day. I don't know." Because I couldn't let you know I was dying inside. I had to put on that, if I'm okay on the outside, I'm okay on the inside. And then this man called me, and he said he was really sick, and could I take him to the emergency hospital? And I took him, and they said he had hepatitis. And I think the hardest thing for me with living with an alcoholic was that my first thought was, "Oh, good, he won't be able to drink." And all the guilt that goes along with, "I love this man, and I'm glad he's sick." And, you know, when he told me a month later, they told me he could drink again, I believed him. I believed everything he told me. And so we did this in Sandy for a while. We dated. We didn't date. And you know, I'd like to say I had the courage to just leave, but I didn't overlap this time, but I did have Bruce in the wings already. It was a Friday, and Bruce asked me for my phone number, and I gave it to him. And on Saturday, I broke up that relationship. And I called him that night, and I said, "Did we do the right thing?" He probably said the smartest thing he ever said. He said, "If we got back together, what would be different?" And nothing would have been different. We would have been back in that insanity again. So we broke up, and I started dating Bruce. And on our first date, he said, "I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And my first thought was, "This cannot be happening to me again." I think they're really cute. And then we were dating, about a month, and he said, "You want to go hear me speak?" That was way more information than you should tell somebody when you've only been dating them a month. And You know, my self-esteem at that point was so low. And, you know, Bruce did things that were really nice. Like, he opened my car door. He paid when we went on a date. He brought me flowers. And I remember asking him why he was so nice to me, because I didn't realize I deserved to be treated nicely. And then we were dating a little longer, and I thought, I really have feelings for him, but I wonder what they are. I wonder if this is love. And so I said to him, you know, I said, there's something about you that makes me want to keep coming back, but I don't know what it is. Now, I wanted him to say, you love me. And I said, okay, that's fine. Now I've identified that. Let's move on. And he said to me, you're attracted to me because I'm healthy. And I thought, well, that's never really been attracted to me before, but, you know, maybe, you know. When we were dating 3 months to the day, it was actually Valentine's Day, and he asked me to marry him. Now, I dated my ex-husband for 7 years. And so I thought 3 months. And Bruce informed me that 3 months in AA was a long-term relationship. It was very interesting because he did say two things to me when he asked me to marry him. The first thing he said was that AA, that his program would become number one in his life, and he would go to 4 or 5 meetings a week for the rest of his life. And if I couldn't live with that, we couldn't get married. Now, the alcoholics in your life may go for 2-day treatment and be okay and never have to go to a meeting. But I can only share my experience, strength, and hope, and that is that Bruce is 33 years sober, and he still goes to 4 or 5 meetings a week. And that's just been my experience. The other thing he said to me was that if God wanted us to be together, there's nothing I was going to do to mess it up. And if God wanted us not to be together, I couldn't keep us together. So if I gained 5 pounds, he wasn't out the door. But on the same hand, if he was supposed to leave and I held him by the ankles or did some of the other undignified things I have done, then he was not staying. And, you know, I knew that day I wanted to marry him, but I had so much fear, and I did not have fear about him. I had fear that if I married somebody nice, I would get bored again and I would screw him over. That was my big fear about me. And so it took me 6 weeks to say yes. If you ask Bruce and I, we have a different perspective. I think I woke up one morning and said, "Ah, I'm ready." Bruce said, he said, "The train's moving on, get on or get off." But I don't remember. So whatever happened, we got married, and last August we celebrated 28 years, and we still like each other. So. Bruce's sponsor's wife took me to my first Al-Anon meeting, and as you all know, I was not real thrilled. I remember somebody saying, first they said there were no children, and I had a big resentment. I didn't have children, but I had a resentment. And then somebody said, my husband dropped his socks on the floor, and I stepped over him and didn't put him in the laundry, and everybody started clapping, and I thought, I must be in the wrong place. Until I had a teenage son, and then I realized the significance of that. But, so I went 6 more months after my first newcomers. I don't recommend this. This was just my path. So it took me 6 months to get to my second Al-Anon meeting, and God took care of me, even when I couldn't take care of myself, because I wanted so much to be different. And I sat here, and somebody sat right across from me, and she was younger than I was, because it looked like all the ladies were blue-haired and about 100 years old. I'm probably older than they are now, but that's how it looked to me. I was 27, and I had never seen Bruce take a drink, and he was 4.5 years sober, and this young gal across from me sat there, and she said, my boyfriend's 4.5 years sober. I've never seen him take a drink. And I went up to her afterwards, and I said, are there meetings with younger people? And she said, Monday night I'll be in Marina Del Rey. I'll have a seat for you. And Monday night when I showed up, she said, tomorrow night I'll be in Culver City. I'll have a seat for you. Then she said, Friday night I'll be at Chelsea and Wilshire. I'll have a seat for you. And I kept going because she had a seat for me. You didn't need to save seats, but, you know, she had a seat for me. And so I started going. And, you know, I didn't do anything right at the beginning. I really didn't. Asked the sponsor who had 6 more months than I did in the program. I asked her for a good reason. I didn't want her to ask me to do the steps or go to meetings. And when I called her once a month to check in, she gave me her loving spiritual program. To this day, she probably has the best spiritual program of anybody I know. And she was the first person that loved me unconditionally. She didn't yell at me when I called her. She just loved me. I did get involved in service. I've always been really involved in service. I took a cookie commitment. I used to walk up and down the aisles to find the perfect cookies. I did not realize you don't fire the cookie person. And so that was the first chink at my perfectionism. And I had my first year Al-Anon birthday, and I knew I needed to do the steps, and I asked somebody to sponsor me who had 19 years on the program. They had a very different idea of sponsorship. Their first words were, write, call me back when you've written. They said I was going to work the steps from 1 to 12 without skipping 2 to 11 in the middle. And you know, I started working this program, and I wrote a very long, boring autobiography for my fourth step, but I did it. And when I got to her house, we did our third step. We did the fourth step. She made a list of people that she owed amends to me. She thought I owed amends to, and she also made a list of my character defects. I did not walk in there with any character defects, thank you very much, but I walked out with several, and she asked me if I was entirely ready to have God remove them. Well, of course, people-pleasing was on them, so I said yes, and so we asked God to remove them. And I still have to do that on a daily basis because they don't, they're not there all the time, but they do come back and visit me. And so we did that. And you know, I just want to share a couple of my amends with you. One was to my father. And when I made my amends to my father, now when after my mother died, my father became the swing single of the San Fernando Valley. And so when I made my amends to my father, he just said, you don't owe me an amends, and he told me I have a date. He had a date Thursday night, so that was the extent of my amends. But I do have to tell you, because this has been a big reoccurring pattern in my life, and that is I did not grow up with a lot of money. We were always struggling financially. My dad was in and out of work, and what the amends I had to make to my father, and I had never shared this with anybody but my sponsor up until a few weeks ago, and that the amends I had to make to my father is my parents sold their house so I could have a wedding. And now they may have been ready to sell anyway because I was the youngest child, but when I made amends to my dad and I told him I was sorry that he did this, he said that was our decision, not yours. And you know, that fear of financial insecurity has plagued me a lot of my program. I've done a lot of writing about it. And a few years ago, Bruce and I, there's somebody in the AA program that Bruce shared with that does financial stuff. And Bruce said, we're going to go in this restaurant. We're going to meet him. We're going to show him all our finances and get help. Now, I have to tell you, I would have rather walked in that restaurant with no clothes on than to show anybody all my finances because I was afraid he was going to judge everything we'd spent money on. And, you know, we did that, and he has been helping us and guiding us through that ever since because I've made so many decisions based on my fear that I will be that homeless person pushing the shopping cart. And, you know, one of the things my sponsor kept telling me was I needed to be self-supporting in my own voluntary contributions. And I used to tell her I paid Bruce's life insurance. She didn't think that was very funny. And but, you know, God decided that he wanted me self-supporting my own voluntary contributions. And Bruce and I were living in West L.A., and his business kind of fell apart. And it became obvious we were going to have to move out to Valencia and that I was going to have to go back to work. And thank God for the people in this program who walked me through going back to school, who walked me through my first day at my job, and who walked me through finding another career. I'm so grateful for that today. The seemingly bad comes out good. I do need to go back to, so my other big amends was to my ex-husband. And when I made my amends to him, he told me, you know, we were young, you don't owe me an amends. And then he said to me, the hurt goes away. And that really had an impact on my life because I never realized that I could hurt you. I knew you could always hurt me and I was the great victim, but I didn't know that I could hurt you. And that was really a life-changing experience when he said that to me. So I finished working the steps, and Bruce and I had decided when we were married a year we were going to have a baby, and when we were married a year we didn't want to have a baby. We were having too much fun, so we kept asking all of you, how did you know when it's time? And they said, you'll know. And we thought that one day you wake up and say, I'm not selfish anymore, I want to have a child. And then you all informed us that you have the child, and then you become unselfish. It's not the other way around. And so we decided we were ready to have a child, and we went through major infertility treatment, and the people in these rooms laughed with us, and they cried with us. And then we finally decided to surrender this, and we got on our knees. Now, we did not surrender until I was in the hospital with complications that we decided that maybe this was a little insane. And we got on our knees, and we surrendered, and we told God that we were willing to be of service to him, and not have a child if that was his will and just be of service. And Bruce also added a few swear words, which I won't say because I'm at the podium. And, you know, 1 week later, a woman came up to me at work and said, you know, I work part-time in a gynecologist's office, and I know a woman that wants to give a baby up for adoption. Would you and Bruce like to talk to her? And, you know, we talked to her, and this was in March, and she chose us. And she had a beautiful baby boy in August, and I quit my job, and life was going to be wonderful, and it was for about 13 days until she changed her mind and she took the baby back. Now, when I got the call, I called Bruce immediately, and Bruce called the sponsor. His sponsor got there before he did. His sponsor held us, and he held the baby, and he said the serenity prayer, and he said, God doesn't take anything out of your life unless he's going to replace it with something better. But when you're in the hallway, it can be painful. Like Jack says, I got to put up curtains and make it pleasant in the hallway because I don't know how long I'm going to be there. And, you know, we gave that baby back, and we knew we had no power over it. We knew we were powerless over that, and you told us you keep on trying whenever you fail. And so and the next morning for me, the hardest thing was I woke up. I didn't have this baby to make me okay. I had quit my job. I didn't have that to make me okay. And I had to be okay just on my own. And so we kept trying, and we got a call from a woman in Portland, Oregon, and she said she had a 4.5-month-old baby boy. Would we be interested in meeting her? And I said, call our lawyer. And the lawyer called back about 10 minutes later and said, this has only happened one other time in 10 years in my practice. She wants to know if you have any drugs or alcohol on your background because her father's an alcoholic. Now, my keen mind said, we're not going to have a child with Bruce's genes, so we're never going to have an alcoholic child. I said to her, you know, there was that moment I thought, well, I don't have to always take the narrow road, but I knew better. I said, I have 5 years in Al-Anon. Bruce has 10 years in AA. And if she would still like to talk to us. And she called me the next day and said, I'm familiar with AA and Al-Anon, and I would still like to talk to you. And we flew up to Portland, Oregon, and we flew home with our son, Jason, who is better than the first. And, you know, my sponsor said to me I'd have to go to daytime babysitting meetings, and I said, well, they're not hip, slick, and cool during the day. And she said her famous line, someday you'll be grateful for this. And you know what? I really was. I went to meetings with these women, and we all had our kids, and we'd go to the meetings, and then we'd go to lunch, and we'd take them to the park. And those were my Steel Magnolia group that I grew up with in Al-Anon. And we all learned how to be mothers together. We all learned how to be wives together. Some of us aren't wives anymore, but we all learned how to do that together. You know, and I was really active in Al-Anon when I was first in Al-Anon. I remember they said to me, my meeting said I should be intergroup rep, and I didn't even know, that was when it was in Monterey Park, I didn't even know when it was. And someone called me and said, I'll pick you up on Friday night. And I can still remember this, and I can't even tell you, this was probably 22 years ago or more. I still remember, she picked me up, we drove down to Monterey Park, it seemed like they spoke Japanese because I didn't understand a word they were saying, and on the way back I had a migraine headache, there was an accident on 10 freeway, it took us so long to get home, I said, I'm never going to that meeting again. Then she called 2 months later, I'll pick you up, I said, I'll be ready. And and you know, I did that, and then I ran for service board, and I probably have spent more years on the service board than anybody else because I ran, and then the next year I ran for chairman and I lost. And then the next year I ran for chairman and I lost again. And I remember calling somebody and I said, what do I do? They said, you pick up cups and ashtrays at your meeting and put your ego aside. And I remember I was going to my last service board meeting in December, and I made the mistake that morning of saying, God, I'm willing to be of service any way you want. Just show me what you want me to do today. And I got to the service board meeting, and the new chairman, who had beat me, said, our editor of the Al-Announcer just resigned. Can you be editor of the Al-Announcer this year? And so I was editor of the Al-Announcer, and this was before computers. We had to hand type this thing. I mean, it was a big job, but it was a good growing experience. And then the next year, God had me run unopposed, so I actually got to be chairman. But then, when we had our son, I was finishing my third year as bulletin editor for World Service, and somebody said, you can have it all, but you don't have to have it all at the same time. And I cut back a little bit on my service above the group level, thinking, you're never going to ask me to do anything again. And I was just, my sponsor told me to be an active member of my meetings, to take commitments at my meetings, and that's what I did. And that worked really well. It kept me coming to my meetings, and it was a lot of fun. And all the time I was growing up. And one of the things all these commitments in Al-Anon did is they taught me how to go out there in the real world and do these things that I didn't know how to do before. And then um, we um, Like I said, we were living in West LA versus business fell apart. We moved to Valencia. When we moved to Valencia, my sponsor said, the meetings there are called, we don't care how you did it in West LA, so keep my mouth shut and go to the meetings. So I did most of the time. I have to be honest. Jack goes to my home meeting. I have to be honest. And, you know, when I got out there, you know, we had this, like, idyllic life. We had this perfect child that was perfect in school. And then he got into junior high school. And he crashed and burned. And I at this point, I was going back to school, and I was working full-time. And he was in junior high, and he was flunking out of junior high. And a friend of mine at work said, you know, my son goes to a school that's for students who are gifted or nearly gifted, who are not succeeding in the public schools. Many of them have ADHD like your son, and perhaps you'd like to check it out. And I'm like, no, we can't afford private school, blah, blah, blah. So finally we got desperate and we went to check out the school. We walked in, it was like, for those of you old enough, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And we walk out and he said, oh, I feel at home. And we called our sponsors and we said, we can't afford this. They said, can you afford this year? I said, yes. And they said, well, trust that God's going to give you the money for the rest of the time. And, you know, he went all through junior high. And I have to tell you, I cannot, and this is honest, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but I know there are other people out here that are the same way. I cannot remember a whole lot of good memories during his teenage years. Our house was a battleground. And we had years and years in the program, and it was a battleground. I wanted my way, he wanted his way, Bruce wanted his way, and it was ugly. That temper I had with that practicing alcoholic came all back to me, and I was not very nice, and I tried to be compassionate. I finally got to the point where I had to take his backpack in the other room and open it so I could find one good thing to tell him how good he was rather than putting him down. And, you know, he made it through till his senior year, and the week he was supposed to graduate, Bruce gets a call on Monday that he hadn't written three papers, and if he didn't write them, he wasn't graduating. And, you know, I called my family in Nevada and in Utah, and I said, you can still come out, but we may not have a graduation. We may just be going out to dinner. And my sister screamed, write the papers for him. Now, one of the things I need to share with you is that I read really slowly, and my brother and sister always told me I was stupid because I read slowly. It took me to be 30 years old for one of you to say to me, you read slow. That's not the same as being stupid. It means you read slow. That's all it means. And so they wrote papers for me when I was going to school, and they always took credit, and I always felt less than. When I went to graduate school and I stood up and got that diploma, I knew I had written every one of those papers on my own. I also had a professor who my last year for our final said, write down what you think would keep you to not be successful in the career you've chosen. And I wrote, I read slowly. And he wrote back and said, what a gift. I read so fast, I don't get any of the details. It must be nice to be able to read slowly. And, you know, he got to turn around that negative. So I told my sister I would not write the papers for him. 3 hours before his graduation, we got a call that he was graduating. They said he turned him in. He just thought it was funny, if you guys didn't know. Today, I think that's funny. Didn't think so then. So he graduated high school, and he went to Utah College, and he came back. And he went up to Humboldt to college, and he came back. And we had to have that talk. Honey, you are self-supporting through your own voluntary contributions unless you are in school. And this is the line you have to add, and getting credits. Because he knew how to go to school, he just wasn't getting any credits. And so, amazingly, he went back to our junior college for 2 years and got straight A's. He has had various girlfriends, most of which, let me put it this way. I wouldn't be surprised if he got an Al-Anon one day. So I can just say that. And his last girlfriend graduated from Humboldt, and he said, can she come back with me and live with us for the summer? Now, my sponsor said, this really is not a good idea, but I was having self-will run riot, so I said, sure, because I'm going to fix her because she was just starting Al-Anon, and I'm going to fix her. Well, some people in this room can testify to how well that worked. It didn't. And our house, one more time, was that battleground. And, you know, I never knew when I opened the door if there would be total silence, if there would be screaming and yelling. And I can't live that way anymore. And it got to the point last summer where we had a really ugly day. And my son accidentally or on purpose, I don't know, knocked some of her stuff over and it broke. And she went to a meeting and she shared that he threw her stuff on the ground. And, you know, I knew the truth, and it was my ego that was saying she has a right to say whatever she wants in Al-Anon meeting, and that was just my ego. And people in here loved her when I couldn't love her. And then she left, and then my son, and because I said I can't live like this anymore, and then our son had one day last summer where he just went crazy. He knocked two holes in doors. He threatened us. We had a suitcase packed to leave if he wouldn't leave, and don't have a crisis at 12:30 on a Friday afternoon because nobody's home. We called like 10 people and couldn't go get a hold of anybody. And, you know, and then he calmed down and he shared with us some things that he said, you guys don't live in reality. And this is what's been going on in my life for all these years. And he's asked me not to share that from the podium. And I will respect that because he lets me share anything else about his life. So I will not share that. But needless to say, it was like a rude awakening to Bruce and I. He is back up in Humboldt. And my friend Liza says that God gives us AFGOs. It's another, and I'm not going to say what the F stands for, growth opportunity that I don't want and didn't ask for. And so he called last week and said he's come. He does not want to be in school anymore, and it's not working for him, and he wants to come home. And, you know, we are trying to live the first tradition in our family, and this is not what I want. You know, I've given up hope that he's going to ever graduate college, and I've given up my ego that he needs to graduate college. And we've been trying to figure out what's best for all of us, and we have had to tell him this last week that it is not comfortable for him to come live in our house again. And now we're working on what financial, if anything, we're going to give him. And my husband is... last night I had to be on the phone with my sponsor and with another Al-Anon friend because my husband is a little more generous than I am, and I felt like I could not be true to myself and be... I don't like living anymore where my insides and my outsides don't match. I did that in West L.A. when our house was, when everything was falling apart, and I acted like we still had all this money, and I don't like to live like that. And I said, I don't know if this, I can live my truth if I do what he wants. But, and ultimately, after I spoke to my sponsor and I spoke to somebody else that I've known for 20 years, what happened is I realized that our unity is more important. And if that means I have to give in on this, I'll give in on this, and I will do what needs to be done. And so that's where we are today, I would like to tell you. But you know what? I absolutely know. This program has given me my life. It has given us a life beyond our wildest dreams. We've been able to go to four. I've been able to go to four or five international conventions. That's where I got to meet some of the people that were here. It's been fabulous. I have the privilege this year of being chairman of the AFG convention. Not little plug, April 8th, 9th, and 10th in Ontario. If you would like any more information because you'd like to be of service and help, talk to John or talk to Jack because they're both on the committee, and I'm sure they would love to give you information. And that's the kind of stuff we get to do in Al-Anon. My biggest fear, Bruce got laid off 3 years ago. He was a trendsetter. It was before all of you got laid off. And you know what? When it first happened, we thought, how are we going to do this? You know what? He was taking double blood pressure medicine because that job was stressing him so much. He didn't even have to take that blood pressure medicine anymore. He would never have quit that job because of our fear of financial insecurity. We were so afraid that we would never get to travel again. God's given us those opportunities. You know, the day after Jason went bonkers and did this whole thing and broke the doors, I had the privilege of going on a panel with somebody in this room, and we got to share our experience, strength, and hope together and cry together, and it was okay. You have given me friends beyond my wildest dreams, people that know me for who I am and not who I want to be on the outside, and have still loved me. I have a group of three women who are my steel magnolias, who I came into Al-Anon with 20 years ago. Now, I love alcoholics. Two of them are now in the other program, too. But anyway, they have been my rock, and I am so grateful for giving me the steps, for giving me a higher power, for giving me women I sponsor who keep me on the straight and narrow, and for giving me a sponsor who helps me and has taught me how to have a sense of humor and how to have a life. And thank you very much.